Chapter 80. Titian bad and Titian good. I wonder why some things are. For instance, art is allowed as much indecent license today as in earlier times, but the privileges of literature in this respect have been sharply curtailed within the past 80 or 90 years. Fielding and Smollett could portray the beastliness of their day in the beastliest language. We have plenty of foul subjects to deal with in our day, but we are not allowed to approach them very near, even with nice, unguarded forms of speech. But not so with art. The brush may still deal freely with any subject, however revolting or indelicate. It makes a body use sarcasm at every pore, to go about Rome and Florence, and see what this last generation has been doing with the statues. These works, which had stood in innocent nakedness for ages, are all fig-leaved now. Yes, every one of them. Nobody noticed their nakedness before, perhaps. Nobody can help noticing it now, the fig leaf makes it so conspicuous. But the comical thing about it all, is, that the fig leaf is confined to cold and pallid marble, which would be still cold and unsuggestive without this sham and ostentatious symbol of modesty, whereas warm blood paintings which do really need it have in no case been furnished with it. At the door of the Uffizi, in Florence, one is confronted by statues of a man and a woman, noseless, battered, black with accumulated grime. They hardly suggest human beings, yet these ridiculous creatures have been thoughtfully and conscientiously fig-leaved by this fastidious generation. You enter, and proceed to that most visited little gallery that exists in the world, the Tribune, and there, against the wall, without obstructing rag or leaf, you may look your fill upon the foulest, the vilest, the obscenest picture the world possesses, Titian's Venus. It isn't that she is naked, and stretched out on a bed, no, it is the attitude of one of her arms and hand. If I ventured to describe that attitude, there would be a fine owl, but there the Venus lies, for anybody to gloat over that wants to, and there is he has a right to lie, for she is a work of art, and art has its privileges. I saw young girls stealing furtive glances at her. I saw young men gaze long and absorbedly at her. I saw aged, infirm men hang upon her charms with a pathetic interest. How I should like to describe her, just to see what a holy indignation I could stir up in the world, just to hear the unreflecting average man deliver himself about my grossness and coarseness, and all that. The world says that no worded description of a moving spectacle is a hundredth part as moving as the same spectacle seen with one's own eyes, yet the world is willing to let its son, and its daughter and itself look at Titian's beast, but won't stand a description of it in words. Which shows that the world is not as consistent as it might be. There are pictures of nude women which suggest no impure thought, I am well aware of that. I am not railing at such. What I am trying to emphasize, is the fact, that Titian's Venus is very far from being one of that sort. Without any question it was painted for a bagnio, and it was probably refused, because it was a trifle too strong. In truth, it is too strong for any place, but a public art gallery. Titian has two Venuses in the Tribune. Persons who have seen them will easily remember which one I am referring to. In every gallery in Europe there are hideous pictures of blood, carnage, oozing brains, putrefaction, pictures portraying intolerable suffering, pictures alive with every conceivable horror, wrought out in dreadful detail, and similar pictures are being put on the canvas every day, and publicly exhibited, without a growl from anybody, for they are innocent, they are inoffensive, being works of art. But suppose a literary artist ventured to go into a painstaking and elaborate description of one of these grisly things, the critics would skin him alive. Well, let it go, it cannot be helped. Art retains her privileges, literature has lost hers. Somebody else may cipher out the whys, and the wherefores and the consistencies of it, I haven't got time. Titian's Venus defiles and disgraces the Tribune, there is no softening that fact, but his osis glorifies it. The simple truthfulness of its noble work wins the heart, and the applause of every visitor, be he learned or ignorant. After wearying oneself with the acres of stuffy, sappy, expressionless babies that populate the canvases of the old masters of Italy, it is refreshing to stand before this peerless child and feel that thrill which tells you you are at last in the presence of the real thing. This is a human child. This is genuine. You have seen him a thousand times. You have seen him just as he is here, and you confess, without reserve, that Titian was a master. The doll faces of other painted babes may mean one thing, they may mean another, but with Eosis the case is different. The most famous of all the art critics has said, there is no room for doubt, here plainly this child is in trouble. I consider that the Eosis has no equal among the works of the old masters, except it be the divine hair trunk of Bassano. I feel sure, that if all the other old masters were lost, and only these two preserved, the world would be the gainer by it. My sole purpose in going to Florence, was to see this immortal Eosis, and by good fortune I was just in time, for they were already preparing, to remove it to a more private, and better protected place, because a fashion of robbing the great galleries was prevailing in Europe at the time. I got a capable artist to copy the picture, Panmaker, the engraver of Dore's books, engraved it for me, and I have the pleasure of laying it before the reader in this volume. We took a turn to Rome, and some other Italian cities, then to Munich, and thence to Paris, partly for exercise, but mainly because these things were in our projected program, and it was only right that we should be faithful to it. From Paris I branched out and walked through Holland and Belgium, procuring an occasional lift by rail or canal when tired, and I had a tolerably good time of it by and large. I worked Spain and other regions through agents, to save time and shoe leather. We crossed to England, and then made the homeward passage in the Cunard or Gallia, a very fine ship. I was glad to get home, immeasurably glad. So glad, in fact, that it did not seem possible that anything could ever get me out of the country again. I had not enjoyed a pleasure abroad which seemed to me to compare with the pleasure I felt in seeing New York Harbor again. Europe has many advantages which we have not, but they do not compensate for a good many still more valuable ones which exist nowhere but in our own country. Then we are such a homeless lot when we are over there. So are Europeans themselves, for the matter. They live in dark and chilly vast tombs, costly enough, maybe, but without conveniences. To be condemned to live as the average European family lives would make life a pretty heavy burden to the average American family. On the whole, I think that short visits to Europe are better for us than long ones. The former preserve us from becoming Europeanized. They keep our pride of country intact, and at the same time they intensify our affection for our country and our people, whereas long visits have the effect of dulling those feelings, at least in the majority of cases. I think that one who mixes much with Americans long resident abroad must arrive at this conclusion. Appendix. Nothing gives such weight and dignity to a book as an appendix. Herodotus. Appendix of the Portier, Omer Khayyam, the poet prophet of Persia, writing more than 800 years ago, has said, in the four parts of the earth, are many that are able to write learned books, many that are able to lead armies, and many also that are able to govern kingdoms and empires. But few there be that can keep a hotel. A word about the European hotel portier. He is a most admirable invention, a most valuable convenience. He always wears a conspicuous uniform. He can always be found when he is wanted, for he sticks closely to his post at the front door. He is as polite as a duke. He speaks from 4 to 10 languages. He is your surest help and refuge in time of trouble or perplexity. He is not the clerk. He is not the landlord. He ranks above the clerk, and represents the landlord, who is seldom seen. Instead of going to the clerk for information, as we do at home, you go to the portier. It is the pride of our average hotel clerk to know nothing whatever. It is the pride of the portier to know everything. You ask the portier at what hours the trains leave, he tells you instantly. Or you ask him who is the best physician in town, or what is the hack tariff, or how many children the mayor has, or what days the galleries are open, and whether a permit is required, and where you are to get it, and what you must pay for it, or when the theaters open and close, what the plays are to be, and the price of seats, or what is the newest thing in hats, or how the bills of mortality average, or who struck Billy Patterson. It does not matter what you ask him. In 9 cases out of 10 he knows, and in the 10th case he will find out for you before you can turn around 3 times. There is nothing he will not put his hand to. Suppose you tell him you wish to go from Hamburg to Peking by the way of Jericho, and are ignorant of routes and prices, the next morning he will hand you a piece of paper with the whole thing worked out on it to the last detail. Before you have been long on European soil, you find yourself still saying you are relying on Providence, but when you come to look closer you will see that in reality you are relying on the portier. He discovers what is puzzling you, or what is troubling you, or what your need is, before you can get the half of it out, and he promptly says, "Leave that to me." Consequently, you easily drift into the habit of leaving everything to him. There is a certain embarrassment about applying to the average American hotel clerk, a certain hesitancy, a sense of insecurity against rebuff, but you feel no embarrassment in your intercourse with the portier. He receives your propositions with an enthusiasm which cheers, and plunges into their accomplishment with an alacrity which almost inebriates. The more requirements you can pile upon him, the better he likes it. Of course, the result is that you cease from doing anything for yourself. He calls a hack when you want one, puts you into it, tells the driver whither to take you, receives you like a long-lost child when you return, sends you about your business, does all the quarreling with the hackman himself, and pays him his money out of his own pocket. He sends for your theater tickets, and pays for them. He sends for any possible article you can require, be it a doctor, an elephant, or a postage stamp. And when you leave, at last, you will find a subordinate seated with the cab driver who will put you in your railway compartment, buy your tickets, have your baggage weighed, bring you the printed tax, and tell you everything is in your bill and paid for. At home you get such elaborate, excellent, and willing service as this only in the best hotels of our large cities, but in Europe you get it in the mere back country towns just as well. What is the secret of the portier's devotion? It is very simple. He gets fees, and no salary. His fee is pretty closely regulated too. If you stay a week, you give him 5 marks, $1.25, or about 18 cents a day. If you stay a month, you reduce this average somewhat. If you stay 2 or 3 months or longer, you cut it down half, or even more than half. If you stay only one day, you give the portier a mark. The head waiter's fee is a shade less than the portier's. The boots, who not only blacks your boots and brushes your clothes, but is usually the porter and handles your baggage, gets a somewhat smaller fee than the head waiter. The chambermaid's fee ranks below that of the boots. You fee only these 4, and no one else. A German gentleman told me that, when he remained a week in a hotel, he gave the portier 5 marks, the head waiter 4, the boots 3, and the chambermaid 2. And if he stayed 3 months he divided 90 marks among them, in about the above proportions. 90 marks make $22. $5.50. None of these fees are ever paid until you leave the hotel, though it be a year, except one of these 4 servants should go away in the meantime. In that case he will be sure to come and bid you goodbye, and give you the opportunity to pay him what is fairly coming to him. It is considered very bad policy to fee a servant while you are still to remain longer in the hotel, because if you gave him too little he might neglect you afterward, and if you gave him too much he might neglect somebody else to attend to you. It is considered best to keep his expectations in a string until your stay is concluded. I do not know whether hotel servants in New York get any wages or not, but I do know that in some of the hotels there the feeing system in vogue is a heavy burden. The waiter expects a quarter at breakfast and gets it. You have a different waiter at luncheon, and so he gets a quarter. Your waiter at dinner is another stranger, consequently he gets a quarter. The boy who carries your satchel to your room and lights your gas fumbles around and hangs around significantly, and you fee him to get rid of him. Now you may ring for ice water, and 10 minutes later for a lemonade, and 10 minutes afterward for a cigar, and by for a newspaper, and what is the result? Why, a new boy has appeared every time, and fooled and fumbled around until you have paid him something. Suppose you boldly put your foot down, and say it is the hotel's business to pay its servants? You will have to ring your bell 10 or 15 times before you get a servant there, and when he goes off to fill your order you will grow old and infirm before you see him again. You may struggle nobly for 24 hours, maybe, if you are an adamantine sort of person, but in the meantime you will have been so wretchedly served, and so insolently, that you will haul down your colors, and go to impoverishing yourself with fees. It seems to me that it would be a happy idea to import the European feeing system into America. I believe it would result in getting even the bells of the Philadelphia Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.